The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I like a long black coffee. Yeah, I know you don't care, but I'm telling you because I make an espresso and then fill it up with hot water straight from my cooker tap. A little bit of magic going on right there in my kitchen. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's hour, I'm curious about depression and what it is. Dean Burnett is a neuroscientist, author, blogger, occasional comedian, and all-round science guy. Well, that's how he describes himself anyway. He's written a few books before. The two I know are The Idiot Brain and The Happy Brain. And his new book is called Psychological, Why Mental Health Goes Wrong and How to Make Sense of It. Let's meet him. Here's Dean Burnett. Dean, thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I've, it's becoming a bit of a slog. Kids are finally going back to school, and it's been a bit stressful trying to get regular work done with them around. But overall, yeah, I mean, it's been a lot worse in the last 12 months, so I'm doing okay now.
I think the best way to start is for you to explain your job, basically, because you do quite a lot of things, and you obviously write a book. So explain yourself to us.
Okay, so broadly speaking, I'm a neuroscientist and author. I have a neuroscience undergraduate degree and a neuroscience doctorate, both from Cardiff University, because I don't like to travel far. It's not nice and convenient that way. And yeah, so not much of a researcher. I'll always be more of a teacher, lecturer, tutor type. So did my undergraduate, did my postgraduate degree, and then spent like 7 years as a psychiatry lecturer and tutor for an online course, teaching doctors how to, the specifics of psychiatry and the various aspects of mental health. But in parallel, I was also getting into comedy and performance and stuff, and ended up writing blogs, which is a combination of both, trying to make science funny, or might try to make funny things scientific, whatever took my fancy. I ended up sort of doing that a lot, and it became quite a thing. Apparently there was a market for that, and ended up writing for The Guardian, and et cetera, et cetera. Ended up getting a book deal. And now that's basically my full-time job. I'm an author now. I write science books, and we'll continue to do that for the foreseeable. So yeah, it's an interesting CV, but I'm happy.
Are you spending the whole of your time though reading up on papers and things, because you write so much about the brain? Is that how you do it?
A lot of it is that, yeah. Because there's so much scientific literature out there, because neuroscience is such a complex field in terms of, there's very little we can be certain about. We have a few established facts, like, we know the hippocampus is to do with memory, we know that neurotransmitters work like this, but in terms of, what are stone cold facts, there's always a little bit of gray area or uncertainty around it, because we can't look at a working brain in specific detail, like up close, because the person's using it, and the technology we have is good, but not quite good enough for that yet. So, I think it helps to start with an idea, with a theory, with a sort of an angle you want to take, and see what data there is there to support it, or at least to outline it. And there've been plenty of times when I've sort of sat down thinking, right, I want to write this, I need to find some evidence. I'm not sort of cherry picking the evidence, but these are things I've learned and I've heard, and I think, right, what's the basis for this? And I looked it up, and it's actually, my information was old, but I've got to change this whole thing now. So yeah, a big part of what I do is trawling the literature for relevant stuff, and then occasionally, actually quite regularly, changing what I'm going to do to reflect what the actual science says.
Yeah, it seems to be moving very quickly in the medical world I suppose because technology and computers have come on board, so it's making things change rapidly. Okay, let's get into your book, Why Mental Health Goes Wrong and how to make sense of it. You start the top of the book by saying you don't have mental health problems. You don't suffer from depression. Why not?
Valid question. Very valid indeed. Yeah, again, I have wondered that. I'm from, I think I outlined in the opening parts of the psychological, the fact that I'm from a background which would, you know, on paper, increase my odds of having depression at some point. I'm from a working class background, like sort of former Welsh mining valley. So, you know, the industry got shut down and a lot of purposelessness and, you know, economic stagnation and deprivation. And I lived in the pub, so I saw a lot of alcohol and things. And, you know, it was very common for people to be depressed around there. And again, that's in the Bridgend area, which is known for, you know, the Bridgend suicide spate in the early 2000s. So, yeah, I mean, it's basically just good luck that I never succumbed to any particular mental health problem myself. A bit of a charmed existence so far, really. I mean, like I say, like, from this area, but I don't think I had a bad childhood. I wouldn't say anything particularly traumatic happened to me during my youth, which is where, you know, normally that's when the scales are tipped in favor of people becoming depressed at some point. Sort of like an insular child, so I didn't go out too much, or didn't become too outgoing, ambitious, so I didn't experience a lot in that respect. I'm a bit of a late developer, so, you know, by the time I started reaching out into the world and exploring my boundaries, I was perhaps mature enough to know better than to do something stupid, or you know, these are all things people do normally. It's just luck of the draw a lot of the time. And but, you know, it doesn't mean I never will, and it doesn't mean I could end up having an assessment now, and they say, actually, you do have signs of this, that, and the other. Like, it would be mild because I'm very functional. But now, this last year, I'm, you know, it could have easily happened. Like, I've said it publicly, but we're approaching the 1 year anniversary of my father dying of COVID. He contracted it very early on, and he had no prior health problems. He's only 58, and I've had to deal with that alone in isolation, cut off from my family, and all the fallout from that. And it's been horrific, you know. And if I didn't have the cognitive reserves I do have to handle it, I could have easily, you know, crossed the line from mentally unwell to mentally unwell. And, you know, it's always luck of the draw. I mean, just because I haven't yet doesn't mean I won't. But that goes for everyone. So, yeah, it depends what life throws at you, I guess. And so far, I've been, touch wood, I've been lucky.
I'm sorry to hear about your dad, Dean. Bad news, terrible news. Sorry about that. Okay, explain your book then. Why did you write it? And what's it about?
Yeah, so this is my fourth book, Psychological, Why Mental Health Goes Wrong and How to Make Sense of It. I'll get the plugs in there or my publicist will yell at me. So it's a book about mental health, but it's about the science of mental health, which in my experience is, I wouldn't say overlooked, but perhaps not prioritized as much as it could be. Because, like I say, I've been writing about mental health in various guises and teaching it for a very long time. And this is my fourth book. More of my other books touch on mental health in some capacity or some form, but they've never been specifically about it. And that was, it wasn't much a conscious decision on my part, but my publisher said, like, you can do that should you feel necessary, but it's perhaps not the best approach, at least not when you're starting out as a science writer, because there have been people in the past who have tried to do a scientific book about mental health, and they've not failed, but they haven't really, you know, caught on, or they've never been particularly memorable, or they haven't caught the imagination like the majority of mental health books these days, which are written from the perspective of someone who has gone through, you know, the mental health system or has experienced poor mental health and various problems, and writing about their journey through that, which is a very valid and perhaps the most valid way to look at it. It's important that the people with the issues get first say. But I think that's, you know, there's plenty more to be said around that. And, next month, I don't know, May is Mental Health Awareness Month. We've just had World Mental Health Awareness Day. And things. So there's lots of campaigns for mental health awareness now. It's a big thing and it's a big issue and people are getting on board with it. And it's helping. It's definitely working. But being a scientist, I've always thought that that's just the start of the process, not the end result. So once people are aware of mental health, where do we go from there? And what's, I'm aware of a lot of things. I'm aware of, you know, famine in some countries. I'm aware of Wi-Fi, but I don't know how these things work or what to do about them. And I think that's where the next thing should be. I think once you have mental health awareness, you need mental health understanding, explaining why it happens, why we're so prone to these things, what's going on in our brains when mental health declines or what happens to our brains to make that take place in the first place. And I think there's a lot to be said around that. And I think most people don't know about that. And I think that's where a lot of stigma comes from.
Do you think there's more people who have mental health problems or just more awareness of it? Like, do you think a lot of people just never say anything to anyone ever?
I think it's a combination of that. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the famous stat that is thrown around a lot, I mean, I mentioned it myself, but it's like 1 in 4 people every year will have a mental health problem of some description. But I think if a quarter of the population suddenly said, you know, hands up, I've got a mental health problem and went to get help about it, they would overwhelm the mental health services like within hours, because that's a substantial amount of people. The fact that doesn't happen then logically suggests that there are, you know, the majority of people just endure, just sort of say, oh, I've got this, but I can get by, or I can handle it, and so on and so on. And in an ideal world, they shouldn't have to. There should be help available for everyone. But I think it's what you say. I think most people are like, well, I've got this, but it's not incapacitating me to the point where I can't do anything. I've just got to work around it or work with it. And yeah, mental health awareness is expanding the general awareness of the fact that people's mental health is vulnerable. It can happen. You know, you can have these issues, and perhaps you should seek help with them if it's available. But so like that will just lead to a higher reported cases anyway. And I know the scientific understanding of them is getting a lot better too. Like the ICD and the DSM, the main go-to mental health reference text, they've constantly been updated by every new development, every sort of redefining of the systems and so on. So, you know, it's a constantly changing, constantly in flux system. So, yeah, so our idea of what mental health problems are and our understanding of them and our ability to recognize them, that's sort of always increasing and changing. So, yeah, you will get a lot more people with mental health problems as a result. And
Dean, I think your book's fascinating, but what I sort of, one of the big takeouts from me was we know very little about the brain, and we know very little about mental health. I interviewed Raul Jandial, who's a brain surgeon here, and I said to him, what do we know about the brain? He said, nothing. I'm just going in there and doing, you know, they know about cutting tumours out, but very little else, you know, as you allude to all the way through your book. My biggest worry about it, after, you know, contemplating all the chapters and everything, was there must be so much misdiagnosis going on. You point out constantly in your book that I'm going to say this and everyone's going to disagree with me. I'm going to say this and this is another point and people disagree with me. So the misdiagnosing of mental health it must be so prevalent in all forms of depression. There must be people saying, you've got chemical imbalance, you've got this, you've got that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. Like that's one of the running themes, in that the current understanding of, you know, where do you draw the line and say this person has gone from mentally well to mentally unwell, that's a really big area, a really big issue, and a very confusing one, because those lines are constantly being revised and redrawn and put elsewhere, which is, you know, it can be, you know, alarming to think that. I think, you know, the finest scientific minds in the world don't know how to approach mental health sometimes, and say what they can't say for certain, this is a problem, this isn't a problem. But the fact that these lines are constantly shifting shows that, you know, more information is being taken in and more understanding, and, you know, things are being changed as a result. So it's both not a good and in some ways an encouraging thing. But yeah, that doesn't really address the original point of, yeah, almost certainly many people are getting the wrong diagnosis. I think it's important to sort of keep in mind, though, that getting the wrong diagnosis isn't necessarily like, you know, an instantly damaging thing, or it's going to be, you know, a serious problem. Because I know people who've gone through the system like for years now, and they've had like 4 or 5 different diagnoses, because the more information comes to light, they behave, you know, the behavior and their thinking starts changing in this way. They think, oh, that's not what we thought it was, it's this thing. And also the way the different diagnoses are treated, you know, they're not completely individual. They're not sort of, you know, counterproductive or mutually exclusive. Antidepressants work very well for an anxiety disorder, or anxiolytics can make you feel better if you've got depression or things like that. Or, you know, if you've got depression and you get medication for it, and later it turns out that you have a manic phase, which means, oh, this isn't depression, this is bipolar. And that is okay. You know, it's not going to cause any harm to have thought it was depression originally, or to have your diagnosis changed. I mean, it happens with physical ailments all the time. Like people have constant sort of like maybe a nagging leg pain, I think, or it could be a sort of a blocked vein, or it could be a muscle problem. And they found out, oh no, it's a tumor in the ASF, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the original diagnosis was harmful in any way. So yeah, there is a lot of confusion there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that any harm's being done, but that can happen. Like you say, and like I make the point about going, it's only 50 years ago that homosexuality was removed from the official text as a mental health disorder. So people before then were gay and were being treated as if they were mentally unwell and receiving treatment for this. And we now know that these so-called conversion therapies they just do harm. They don't do any good to anyone, but they were the official medical approach for quite some time. And that's really disconcerting to learn. And so you can't change the past, yeah.
So the categories that you discussed there, things like bipolar, depression and stuff like that, how accurate do you think they are then? I mean, do you think we could have got those wrong?
Yeah, they've been revised all the time. I think if you think in terms of ballparks, and then like, okay, so we know that most people with this disorder have these particular traits or these symptoms, and therefore they fit that diagnosis and they should they can be treated in this way. But you know, a lot of psychologists from the psychological side argue that this whole diagnostic process isn't necessarily the best way. I mean, the psychological approach would be to take each patient individually, I'd say go through them and say, what are your symptoms? What is happening to you? And not trying to tailor it to a specific diagnosis, but to get all that information and then say, okay, so here's your problem, and come up with like a bespoke therapy package and say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to try this. We're going to try that. We're going to try the other. And that sounds like it should be a much better way of doing things. And for many people it is, but also then that has the downsides of everyone gets a brand new diagnosis, that means everyone has to have a whole new treatment regimen worked out. And that takes time and effort and trial and error. And that's, that can be less helpful than saying, okay, this sounds like depression, so here's some medication, here's some therapy, which can help that. And, but yeah, you are right. They are constantly being revised and redrawn and shifted. I mean, until very recently, OCD was considered an anxiety disorder because it comes a lot of anxiety. But now they've revised the category. So now it's compulsive disorders have their own system because they have a very different underlying mechanism in the brain. So yeah, these things are constantly being shifted. And I think that there is a lot of valid concern about, I think one of the examples I use is that depression in the DSM, the Diagnostics and Manual in America, which is the go-to psychiatric text for a lot of people, depression has like 9 criteria. So you need to have 5 to get a diagnosis. So these are 9 things which people with depression have. If you have 5, then yes, you can have a depression diagnosis. But that means you can have someone who has symptoms 1 through 5, or some symptoms 5 through 9. They both get the same diagnosis and almost completely different symptoms. And when you look at it that way, then yeah, that is a little bit disconcerting. As in, you can have people with very, very different expressions or problems and getting the exact same treatment. Is that a valid approach? And that's where a lot of the current discussion falls down there as well.
Okay, we're sort of going all over the place here, but I think one of the cures for depression is always, and you mentioned it a few times, antidepressants. But there's a big movement which says they don't work. What is the science on that now?
I can say that I can totally understand why people think antidepressants don't work or aren't as or they're cracked up to be. And I think a lot of that comes down to how they're portrayed and discussed in the mainstream. Like I said, the idea that they're a cure, that's not really what they're meant to do. They're a treatment in that they can alleviate the symptoms of depression and make people feel better than they were, but it doesn't necessarily fix the underlying problem. It just sort of gets people back to a point where they can function. It's a usual comparison, but like insulin doesn't cure diabetes. It just stops it doing harm, which is a different thing. But yeah, like this idea that it works like an antibiotic, like you take it and the problem goes away. That's very rarely, if ever, the case with any mental health problem that we can do that, because the underlying cause of it is either unknown or uncertain or something we can't do much about. Like if your brain's been developed in a way which makes it do this, which is unhelpful, we have no technology yet to go in and fix that. So this idea that they're a cure or a fix is perhaps unhelpful to the general idea of antidepressants anyway. But yeah, they're not ideal. They're not brilliant. They have a lot of problems in that you take antidepressants and the therapeutic symptoms, the things that make your depression feel better, typically, the ones we use these days mostly, they take 2 to 3 weeks to kick in to make you feel better. And that's not great. And sometimes during that 2 week period, they can make you feel worse. Like one of the symptoms of a lot of antidepressants is a period of suicidal ideation. They make you feel more depressed at first. You have to sort of tough it out and then you'll feel better afterwards. And that's not great. You know, if someone's feeling particularly badly depressed and they take antidepressants and feel worse, then yeah, of course they're going to say, these don't work. These just make me feel horrible. And it's a valid concern. I mean, a lot of the antidepressants, when and how they use, their effectiveness is weighed up against the symptoms they have, the side effects, sorry, the symptoms. Like SSRIs, your Prozac, those are the most common antidepressants. But they're not, on paper, they're not the most effective, they're not the best ones. They are just the, if anything, they're the mildest ones. So they have the least side effects. So like if you take these, you might feel a bit rough, but you won't feel particularly bad. Whereas if you take these other ones, they'll tackle your depression better over time, but they'll make you feel awful in the first 2 weeks. So yeah, there's a lot of confusion caused by this side of things too.
So the way they work basically is they're going to change the chemical balance in your brain. So a lot of people, when they talk about mental health, they say it's a chemical imbalance. Now, I assume there's various degrees of that. There's one where your body just doesn't make the right chemicals. Or, right. My basic understanding is the brain is chemicals, and it's moving chemicals around somehow with energy, and that's how your thought processes are working, and that's what's in charge of your emotions and your mental health. So, but also if you're under extreme stress, then the chemicals start altering in your brain too. You've put your book into chapters on depression and anxiety and addiction, and we can go through that in a minute. But so is that how antidepressants are working, that the chemical has got imbalance in your head, whatever reason, and the antidepressants are trying to change the chemicals to make your brain work again, or subdue the pain you're going through? I'm using pain, that's probably a bad word too.
Oh, that's good, man. I think that's totally valid. I think anyone I know with depression will happily agree it's a painful process. That's why it's debilitating, and that's perfectly valid thing to say. It's essentially that's what they're doing. Like it's the chemical imbalance theory is, as far as I can make out, inspired or stems from how antidepressants work. Like the particular chemicals in this case are neurotransmitters, the brain chemicals that brain cells use to communicate with each other, to fire signals back and forth, to do everything the brain does. And antidepressants, they take some of those which are depleted, or like the lower people with depression have lower levels of these, and they raise them back up via various chemical processes. So the brain has as a sort of a more standard level of these chemicals than it does in the depressive phase. So yeah, that is what they do, and that's why for a long time people believe that depression was just a deficit of these particular chemicals. But it's sort of moved on a bit since then, because like I said, the antidepressants take 2 weeks to kick in terms of the therapeutic effect they have, but the chemical effect they have is pretty much instant. You swallow an antidepressant and a few minutes later your brain chemical levels are back up to the level they should be. But if it was just if that's all it was, if depression was just a lack of these chemicals, then it should be resolved right away. But it's not. It takes several weeks. So
why?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. So now we've sort of concluded, it seems a lot more obvious, no, not obvious, but a lot more clear now that this lack of chemicals is more like a downstream effect of whatever's caused the depression rather than the actual cause itself. It's an important part of it. It does mean that you can't function properly and your brain does things which are unhelpful. But it's not the be-all and end-all of it. Lots of different theories at the moment. Some point to inflammation, as in the constant stress causes an inflammatory response, like an immune response in the brain, which causes disruption, because that's what can happen when too much chemicals congregate in one area, or things, parts of tissue swell up and stuff. But what I focus off in the book, because it's sort of my field, is the neuroplasticity theory, which is that the very many complex and intricate neurological systems, which sort of handle mood and change of mood and our ability to feel happiness and joy and pleasure at things. Constant levels of stress, be it all in one big massive dose or just constant and persistent over time. And that causes these particular neurons to become exhausted. Not so much they don't die, but they sort of shut down or become fixed in place. Like they can't change, they can't adapt to the situation. So they go into standby effectively. And that means we get locked into this low mood because obviously the stress put us there. And therefore they have less activity, which means less chemicals. And antidepressants, one particular mechanism is that they coax them back into life, but by stimulating them with these more chemical levels. But it takes time to do that.
It's always the weird thing about it, though, is the placebo effect, because that's just as very powerful. So we're kind of, as I understand it, it's a powerful. So we're able to do that ourselves, aren't we? To sort of kickstart ourselves again.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the placebo effect is. It's really interesting when it comes to mental health stuff, because you can say that, no, this doesn't have any active ingredient. It's just a placebo. But if it were like we talk about trying to cure a cold or something, then yeah, you can say, well, you've still got the virus, you've still got this, but you'd feel better because of the placebo effect. But when it's a mental health problem, that line's a lot fuzzier. So if you're taking this medication, whatever it is, it could be just like a blank pill, like a vitamin tablet someone's told you is powerful medicine. If you take it and you feel better, then you're mentally feeling better when you were mentally not good before. So it is technically working, and it's that line between placebo effect and actual effect is a lot murkier when it comes to mental health stuff. Again, a lot of it's to do with the brain is kind of self-sustaining and self-promoting and self-boosting. So anything which sort of gets its defenses back into play will probably work, and that can mean. With mental health stuff too. So yeah, I mean, the placebo effect is a very useful and potent thing, just kind of hard to control.
I'm going to ask you a horrible question here, but if 100% is knowing everything about the brain, where do you think we are as a percentage of knowing about the brain at the moment?
I'd say we're solid 10. We know the outlines. It's like we've got an atlas, but we don't know where the cities are, the populations. So
that's what I thought. It's. Yeah. I loved reading your book because I'm fascinated in it, and I've had depression, mental health issues, anxiety. I've had all those things, but I don't know what the collective term is for it all now. And so I'm reluctant. I'm going to talk a bit about me now, but I'm reluctant to do this because I don't want anyone to think this is the solution for them. But it's funny, there's this light bulb moment which can change. So that's why I'm fascinated by the brain. I read a lot of stuff on the brain because I'm fascinated by it, or consciousness and everything else, because I'm interested in it. And there's a bit in your book which really hit home with me, because it said there's also an interesting school of thought that argues that depression is an evolved process, meaning it's meant to happen. Now, I went to see a therapist once and I was all over the place, didn't know what I was doing with my life. And again, can I just stress, this helped me, but it might not help you. So don't rely on me for this. But I went to him and he said, and I sat down and I said, I am depressed. And he said, that's a good thing. And I went, why? And he said, well, it's your body telling you that there's something wrong. Now you've got to find out what's wrong and go and change it. And so for me, it was all about thought process, society, the way I view life, et cetera, et cetera. And I think I've got a bit of a better handle on life from that. But it was that moment which clicked with me. And then I thought, hold on, I can now do something about this, because it sort of empowered me again to go, right, I've got something I can do now, a challenge. And it seemed to kick my brain back into gear, that sort of like placebo effect, as we're talking there, sort of switch. Oh, I can do something about this now. I've got to now find out what's wrong with me. What is the thought process between about it being meaning? What did you say? Sorry, I forgot. You said, I just read it and there you go. School of thought that argues that depression is an evolved process. What is that thought process?
This podcast is sponsored by Main Brace, which is a premium golden rum, run by a family based in Cornwall and sourced in the Caribbean. Its name is a nod to the naval tradition of splicing the main brace, which was a tough ask on a ship and was rewarded with rum when completed. It's now come to mean a toast to victory. It's a very smooth drink that is delicious on its own, or simply paired with tonic or ginger ale, and also rum-based cocktails. It's just won a gold at the Rum Masters and has a unique flavour thanks to it being a blend of two styles of rum, one from Guyana and one from Martinique, two styles never before bottled together. If you go to mainbracerum.com, use the promotional code CheersTim. If you buy a bottle of Mainbrace Premium Golden Rum or Mainbrace Navy Strength Rum, you get a free case of Fever Tree Tonic Water, which is 8 cans. So that's use the promo code CheersTim. The promotion is available until May the 31st. Back to the podcast, sponsored by Mainbrace Premium Golden Rum.
Yeah, well, I think like it's such a common thing, depression. And like when something happens so often, it sort of seems unlikely that every single person is, you know, their brain is going, quote unquote, wrong in exactly the same way. It suggests there's some sort of underlying mechanism, which, or like an inclination to do this, which usually means that's something we've evolved to do. And that is, the logic is actually quite sound, I think, in that if you think of us as primitive creatures, you know, living out in the wild day to day, trying to survive, we will look, you know, as a species, as individuals, we'll experience a lot of traumatic things. You know, the humans used to die quite readily back then because the world was big and scary full of predators and dangers and risks. So we would experience a lot of, you know, day to day traumatic things because that was just how life was. And when you experience a sort of a powerful emotional encounter or just a powerful emotional thing anyway, it takes your brain time to process that. It's not like something which can just slot in straight away. Like, again, people will say this, like PTSD is a big part of that. You have an intense, powerful emotional experience and it takes your brain quite a while to work through that. And when it can't do it, that causes problems. But yeah, but it's a gradual process. So there will be times when you need to think, right, I've experienced so much unpleasant stuff. And you can't sort of, you shouldn't keep adding to it. You couldn't keep going out there and saying, right, okay, tomorrow I'm going to go hunt an elk and then I might get killed by tigers and then I'm going to go forage for food and some of us might die in the trip. And you need time to stop and just do nothing so your brain and body can have a chance to recover. But, you know, when life means, you know, day-to-day struggle, you can't do that. So depression, as it's argued, evolved to, well, it's like a brain not giving you a choice. It's, no, you need to sit down now. You need to think about this. You need to work through this because otherwise we're not going to get anywhere. And that's sort of the argument as to why depression is an evolved response to things. And I think there's a lot of merit in that in terms of, you know, depression as a general thing. Like, yes, we do feel really sad for long periods. You know, I said I've just gone through a rather intense bout of grief myself. And I know it's a normal, natural thing because your brain's going, something really bad has happened here. And you can't just pretend that didn't happen. That's where a lot of problems come from, when people don't acknowledge their emotions or don't recognize them or suppress them. It's like you're trying to sort of block a dam and the pressure builds up and eventually it'll rupture and then you'll have more and more problems. And you know, like a lot of guys are inclined to do this. Like the suicide rate for men under 35 is ridiculously high. And that's, you know, a lot believed to be a big part of that, the whole machismo where you can't show emotions or you must never ask for help or you must never openly admit these things. So, you know, it's potentially quite likely that we have systems in place at a fundamental level that stop us from doing that, or at least don't let us do that. And it's when it's sort of, you know, it's when that part doesn't stop either. So like one of the main problems of depression is like, it's not that you feel depressed, it's that you can't stop feeling depressed. It's like, you know, it's been 2 weeks of sustained low mood. You have no motivation, you have no ability to experience pleasure. The brain being fixed in any one state isn't normal for the brain. It's such a flexible organ and things change all the time. So it's when it goes from being healthily, you know, low mood to fixed low mood, that's when it's sort of deemed to be unhealthy. So yeah, it's definitely part of us to experience harsh times and traumatic incidents and want to dwell on those and sort of, you know, being unable to stop thinking about those so we can work through them better. But when we can't stop doing that, or when we do it too much, or too much of an extreme, it becomes even more debilitating.
And I wonder whether modern society is creating. You know, we had that discussion at the beginning whether it was more awareness or more depression. I wonder if modern society, you know, years ago, when there was no mobile phones, you'd come back and someone would have to bring your landline, and then you'd have a bit of maybe stress when your landline rang late at night. But now you can 24 hours a day. you can lock yourself into your social media. You can have people have a go at you. You can have fictitious debates with yourself about the royal family and whatever else you want to do about politics, or, you know, and you can keep those stress levels going. And I'm seeing a lot. I mean, I notice celebrities, because I follow them on social media. A lot of celebrities go on every day to social media and they just kick, like they call it a clickbait. But what they're doing is they're just igniting that stress level where people are going to argue with them about something or other. And, you know, we're human, so I assume we're all going to, the anxiety hits and the stress levels hit. So I'm not making a point here, but apart from the fact that I'm feeling that maybe that's why we can't switch off. But what I'm interested in is you've separated anxiety, depression and addiction. The three of them seem to all go hand in hand, don't they?
Yeah, totally. And that's sort of why I focused on those in this particular book, is in they have their own sort of, neurologically, you can sort of split them into, okay, here's what we think is happening in depression, here's what we think is happening in anxiety, here's what we think is happening in addiction. But that is sort of, it's a helpful fiction in a way, in that the idea that, you know, they might have distinct processes, but the fact that these things won't be linked is, you know, completely misrepresenting how the brain works, because everything is linked to everything else. Like every experience you have does filter out into all the other parts of your brain, which handle every other thing. So every memory you have is a combination of all the emotions and senses you have at any one moment, and that will inform your other ones. So they'll be linked to every other memory, which means, like, but that's your base of all knowledge. So every experience you have is informed by that, and then how you interpret it, and so on and so on. So although there are apparently, as far as we can see, distinct neurological mechanisms which lead to things like depression, anxiety, and addiction, there's a lot of overlap, a great deal of overlap between them. Like I think I mentioned that people with mental health problems are, you know, statistically more prone to becoming addicts as well, because, and by and large, it's because, like, they are trying to self-medicate, like they want to feel better, and things like alcohol is readily available in modern society, and drugs aren't particularly hard to come by if you know where to find them. And it's very much, you know, it's going to tip the scales in favor of you trying these things in the first place, which is obviously step one of experiencing addiction. And, you know, anxiety and depression seem to have a lot of overlap, in that, you know, 30% of people have both, you know, people with either have the other one as well at some point. And it could be the case that there is a common mechanism which leads to them. And it looks like, from my studies, one contender is, like you say, it's like stress. Stress is, okay, it's an important part of how the brain deals with the world and reacts to things, but it's sort of like become a bit of an evolutionary Achilles heel, in that the human brain has never, it didn't evolve to do anything specific, but the idea of long-term chronic stress which keeps coming and doesn't go away, that's a relatively new thing in terms of our species. Because you think of other creatures, all of which have a stress response, like your rats and your chimps and your rabbits and your lizards and stuff, they all have a stress reaction, but their stresses tend to go away. You know, and so, like, you're faced by a predator, either it gets you or you escape. So, you know, it's gone away. Or, like, you're hungry, either you die of hunger or you find food. So it goes away at some point. It's like a short, sharp shocks of stress. Whereas the human brain now has the ability to be stressed about things which haven't happened or may never happen, or, you know, are happening somewhere else, which don't affect us directly. The idea of being rejected, the idea of, you know, my career not going to plan in the next 5 years, or the economy not doing well, or the strife in a different country. And it's like you say, like, because we're interconnected now, we're exposed to so much more information which can stress us out, and so many more people who can interact with us in ways which we do find stressful, that although we are technically a lot more comfortable these days than we ever have been as a species, you know, back in the dawn of time, we still have a lot more things to look at which can cause us to be stressed. And that is, I imagine, another contributor to the rates of mental health that we're seeing, mental health problems specifically.
Yeah, life is overwhelming, isn't it, I think? And I think it's becoming more overwhelming. We all know for a fact, if you take away the pandemic tomorrow, I assume this is a fact, mental health will improve in the country. And I think we all know for a fact that if we take away mobile phones, iPads, computers, probably mental health will improve for the country too. And if you take away 24-hour news as well,
that's probably a big contender.
I think it was, and we all know this, and yet no, everyone's reluctant to say it. I listened to a podcast recently where a guy, a neuroscientist, like yourself was saying, that we know now for a fact that, you know, if you can keep technology away from children as long as possible, it's beneficial to them because they are suffering stress levels from being interconnected. And it's like, hold on, we know this. And yet we're still, like, kids are being still flogged computers and iPads and whatever, and iPhones and everything else. Surely it's about time as a society we start going, life can't be that overwhelming. We cannot have this amount of information coming into us every day.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an argument for that. I think it would be a helpful step, maybe a first step, or maybe just, you know, see what happens when we do it. If somehow we could limit the amount of time people can spend online every day. So, like, say if every device came with a preset, counter of, like, you've had 8 hours, say, that's plenty. Come on now, go outside, read a book or something. So I think there could be something to do with that. It's hard to say because, like, you know, at what point now is the genie out of the bottle? Like, so if I've got kids and they have, during the pandemic, it's different, obviously, because they can't speak to their friends normally. They can't interact. So the technological aspect is the only thing they have. And that's, you know, I think it's more important to stay connected than not connected with anyone. And that's technology has been essential for that respect. But yeah, outside of the context of lockdown and pandemic, what would be the best approach? So, you know, if you had kids now, you say to them, you don't get any technology until you're this age, that could be potentially healthier for them. But if everyone they interact with is doing these, has devices and does things online, then they're the ones who are missing out and then feel excluded. And that can be just as stressful, if not more stressful, from a child's perspective, particularly when peer approval is important and they're still learning how the world works. So, yeah, if it was to be done, it would have to be done en masse by everyone, because any other way is just going to cause fragmentation, isolation, and lack of connections, which is sort of the problem in the first place. So there are upsides to these things. Like, nothing's ever black and white like this. I mean, there's done some studies which show that people who are online all the time, on social media particularly, they can show very negative impacts on their mental health. But there are also some ways which can be very positive. And sometimes it depends on how you use it. So if you're a passive user, so if you're someone who's got Instagram and you're just scrolling through it day after day after day, you're only seeing the other people's pictures and images, and they're only seeing how other people want to present themselves to the world. So they might have spent like 2 hours picking this perfect selfie or making this particularly beautiful photo, and that's all you're seeing of them. Whereas from your own perspective, you know the good parts of your life and you know the bad parts too. So you're thinking everyone's got a great life, it's got it all together, and I'm the only one who's a loser here. I'm the only one who has problems, and that clearly can stress you out further. But if you interact more, if you find people you can connect with and have healthy exchanges, then that can improve your mental health, particularly if, you know, you're not comfortable talking to your family about issues you have, but you'll find a community of sympathetic strangers. And that can be a real boon to your well-being and stuff. So, great. Yeah, it depends on how you use it, really.
Humans are so weird, though. We're such a strange species. We've got this thing like, well, I'm really aware I'm so addicted to my phone, and I'm really aware when I had a back operation, it got so bad that I got a blister on my finger from holding my phone. I mean, that's how ridiculous. I was too scared to look at. I was so bored that I was just going, I was finding the only thing which would stimulate me was my phone and going through social media. And since the pandemic, it's got bad again because I don't go out as much. And so I realized that, and I'm aware of it. So I hate looking at my teenage daughters because they are so, like, addicted to their phone. We are so interconnected. And then what I sort of say to my kids and what I say to everyone is stop watching the news. But then humans are so twisted that we start going, silence is violence. If you're not speaking up about an issue, then you're the problem. It's, oh, hold on, I can't do everything here. And it's like somewhere in Outer Mongolia, there's an issue. Why aren't you speaking about that? And it's like, oh, Christ, that as well as this and this. And I've just sort of switched off now. I'm desperately trying to stay healthy in the rest of this pandemic. But it's tough because I realize the addiction I have, and our brains get very drawn into the addiction. Do we know why we're so addicted to churning through social media constantly?
Oh, yeah, totally. There are so many different aspects of the brain which are so stimulated by this. Like, human brain is incredibly social for a start. Like, we have so much of our brain which is dedicated to facilitating human interaction, forming relationships, connecting, or just having feedback. Because we calibrate our sense of self by how other people speak to us or what they say and how they interact with us. So it's a big part of who we are, like our interactions with others. A lot of our emotions are based on that. Like the emotion of embarrassment doesn't exist if you're on your own. Like you know, if no one's around, you can't be embarrassed because no one knows it. The knowledge that other people might look at you and think, oh, what are you that for? That's, you know, that gives you a real deep sense of dread sometimes. And so, yeah, so we are really attuned to that anyway. And social media allows us to interact with others just in any particular level, but in a sort of safe way in that, you know, they can't see us, but we can interact with them. We can choose how to present ourselves a lot more. We can, you know, take time over the specific tweet or the reply or the post you want to make. So anything which gives the brain a sense of control and, you know, the ability to socialize, it's going to be quite, it's going to lap it up. It's going to really enjoy that. Because, you know, it's like a double whammy of good things that our brain tends to think positively of. And, you know, just general interaction, just having these people in your life, like, you know, we do respond positively to any sort of social interaction, which isn't negative. So if you just put like one tweet or one post and you get 50 likes, that you feel good about that because your brain's recognizing that and going, okay, so I made 50 people happy. 50 people like me now. And that's really a big part of who we are. And the whole, again, I think they call it doom scrolling, you know, just going through your feed, even though all the news is bad and terrible things are happening, you still can't help but do it. You sort of, you know, keep refreshing, keep scrolling down and so on and so on. And a big part of that has to do with like uncertainty and novelty. The brain does not like uncertainty, but it does like novelty. So something new happens or some new bad thing, which again, it tends to be more stimulating because the brain's always looking for threats. Okay, there's a bad thing here. Like that's a threat. I need to know about that because otherwise it might affect me. And then people are talking about it. Okay, so I need to know, as bad as this is, I need to know what's happening. Otherwise I'll be left with gaps in my knowledge. I'll be left with uncertainty and I'll left with this unease that I don't know what's happened and why it's happening and what's going on. So we do feel compelled to find out. The more people tell us about it, the more informed we feel. And that sort of has a feedback loop. Yes, good, let's keep doing that. And yeah, so there's loads of different ways in which this current setup, you know, feeds the brain what it likes. But I think it comes back to what you said earlier, in many ways, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again anytime someone wants to listen, that it does, you know, the brain likes it, but it's almost like the same way like our body likes pure sugar. Like, you know, it's tasty, it gives us energy, but you eat too much, you're cutting out the stuff you do need, you know, the roughage, yeah, the vitamins, the nutrients, and that's when problems can arise, yeah.
That's why I think my brain's like my bicep. I like doing push-ups, but if I keep doing them, my arm's going to hurt. And scrolling, I like doing that. But I do find that when I finish scrolling, sometimes at the end of a day, because I've spent so much time online reading up and doing everything, that my brain is actually tired. Now, let's get to some important points here, because you've got so much knowledge on this. If you are depressed or you've got anxiety, panic attacks, these sort of things, what should you do? Because it is a minefield for people out there, isn't it? I mean, the drugs, the doctor can spend 10 minutes with you talking and then diagnose. There's a therapist. There's so many different things. What's the best advice for people, do you think, after all the knowledge you know?
I think the first step would be, if you're at the point where you've recognized that you have something going wrong and you want to do something about it, that's obviously the first step, which people should, again, don't take that for granted either. There are so many people out there who have issues, who are either too scared or too deep in it to recognize or admit it because of various reasons, or like they've been brought up in an environment or a culture which does not reward that or discourages it. So, you know, even getting to the point where you say, yeah, I've got something going wrong here and I'd like some help with this, that's a big achievement in and of itself. So, you know, even that is a kind of a hurdle to get over. So, but once you get to that point, okay, it really depends on the person, the problem they have. But I think the more you know, the better you'd be at it. I think that's the first step. And so you think you've got this problem, and you know, you can look it up. There's plenty of resources out there now, all the mental health charities, which will happily share any information that you need with you. But if you can, I think one thing I've heard a lot of people say is they find it really reassuring to find that other people are in the same boat. So like I mentioned earlier on, if you are online, if you're engaging with other people, then you can hopefully find someone who is going through what you're going through, like a message board, a forum, a Facebook group. I think Jordan Brooks, the comedian, he was recently talking about his pure OCD stuff, and he was ruining his life. But then he said he looked up online the symptoms he had and found other groups of other people talking about the exact same thing he has. And the first time didn't feel alone. And that was like a massive weight off, a massive boon, and let him appreciate the fact that I'm not weird here. I've got an issue which people know about. And I think that's a big part of it. So finding out in a tangible sense that you're not unusual. There's nothing sort of quirky or unique about you. Yeah.
Can I add to that as well? I was feeling bad, I read Matt Haig's book, because it just stuck out to me in the bookshop. And I did a lot of reading. That's what I did. It's like you're saying, get as much knowledge as possible. So I just started reading and reading. You know, I've read your books. And it's just to try and get as much knowledge as possible. And Matt Haig's book stuck out, Reasons to Stay Alive. And in it, I started reading about anxiety. And I just always thought, I thought I had depression. And then I read about anxiety. I went, oh, I get that too. And then I traced it back that the anxiety is actually the thing which is triggering the depression. So it was really nice to get that knowledge, because I realized I was staying in anxiety for long periods of time. Then I started, I remember one day reading about, and it just, you know, I've had great people on here like Megan Hine, who explained about accepting situations in life. And the whole stress level thing was one of my real issues. And I remember reading about, I think it's Deer, when their stress levels go up really high. Was this in your book? I can't remember where I've read this. It was recently, actually. Their stress levels go up really high, and within seconds, they've come down again after someone's, like a predator's come along, because they don't spend the whole of their life in stress like we do. And that really made
sense.
That sort of stuff really made sense to me back then. That's what I was getting into. Reading's really good. Sorry, I interrupted what you were saying about how to deal with it.
No, but that's totally valid. I mean, again, that's a really good thing, is in finding out that what's happening to you isn't unique to you. It's like you're not the one person in a world of perfectly healthy people, and you're an anomaly, or you're a quote-unquote freak, as some people like to use the term. But so I think that's a big part of it, knowing that, you know, this is quite common. And that's, a lot of the stuff I write is basically trying to get to that, saying, yes, this stuff happens, and it doesn't happen to just one person. This is like a very common thing. This is how the brain does stuff. I mean, it doesn't do it help. It's not helpful. It doesn't do it for our benefit, but it is a thing that human brain is just sort of prone to doing occasionally. And if it happens to you, then that's no sign that you're a flawed person in some way, just that you've, you know, been dealt a bad hand in this particular context, and stuff can be done about that. And yeah, so I think if you can, you know, find out what other people have gone through first, that'll give you an idea of how to go about this. I mean, they always say, like, if you need help, you should seek out help, or like, I'm here to talk and stuff. But that, again, that itself is a big ask. So I think a lot of people might feel better from doing their own thing at first, at least, to sort of at least know that they're not, they're not alone in this, and that what's happening to them isn't unheard of. And I think, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, there's plenty of help out there, but, you know, the mental health system is really overtaxed and underfunded, and there should be a lot more available, which, you know, it depends where you are, what you've got, and what service you're under. So, you know, it can be a struggle. It can be a challenge to get the relevant help you need via the healthcare system, because, you know, lots of issues and quirks and problems and ideological concerns are there as well. So, yeah, so like when people say, you know, you just need to ask for help, then that's, I'm sure they mean well, but that in itself is a tricky thing. But I will say something I've often seen quite a lot during my exploits is that if there's something that helps you, as long as it's not causing you any particular damage, you know, you say like somebody helps you, oh yes, class A drugs, well, that's not really a great way of doing this. But if it's something that helps you, it doesn't matter what it is. If it's helping you, then that's cool. Like if it's, I've heard some people say they're in the grips of depression and the only thing keeping them going was the fact that they hadn't, you know, the comic theory, they hadn't finished this current story, this weekly release, so they kept actually waiting for the next one and the next one. And that's enough. You know, if it keeps you there, if it keeps you in the game, keeps you invested, that's fine. It's not stupid. That's not frivolous. That's not childish or anything. It's keeping you going. And that's an important thing to recognize. So I don't think there's any sort of, you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way. If it works for you, then it works. And that's probably the most important take-home message I can give. As long as it'll cause you more harm, obviously, that depends on each individual situation too. So yeah.
I always think it's when I was thinking, I'm using my brain to try and fix my brain. I was reading so much. That's why I started this podcast. I've said this so many times, I bored my listeners with it. It's because I'd read so many self-help books that I thought, well, I might as well start doing a podcast about this stuff.
Yeah, that's the good ones, yeah.
Do you think, finally, really, do you think we're doing enough on research on the brain? It's such a complex issue, but are we doing enough? Are we putting enough resources in it worldwide or globally, I suppose?
I think yes, in terms of, you know, how much has been put into research and to what extent. I mean, there's so many different developments and projects in the line. But I think it's still kind of worth flagging up anytime this comes up that neuroscience is still a relatively new science. I mean, like, the brain scanners only became sort of widespread use in the 90s. So we're talking like 20 years, which is still not a great deal of time when it comes to pitching a project, getting funding, setting it up, running the study, and doing it in, you know, doing it in crunching the numbers and then getting it published. And so we're talking like many years turnaround time for each individual experiment. So that will be an issue as well. And that's just how science works sometimes. Like, it's really hard to avoid the notion that, yes, there's lots of science out there and all these experiments have taken place in this relatively new discipline, but, you know, a lot of these won't bear fruit. Like, they'll sort of, well, we think this happens, study it. Oh, it doesn't. Well, we'll try something else then. And yeah, so I think enough money and effort's been put into it. Definitely neuroscience is kind of a big deal at the moment. It's like, it's one of the fashionable sciences, but, yeah, so how much that research will actually prove to be particularly useful in the long term, that's really impossible to say, as is any study.
Dean, a paper's coming thick and fast at the moment. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, in my experience, yeah, yeah, definitely is happening. But again, it's sort of, look at the fundamentals, we saw the fundamental level. So, like, you know, we've got this here, right? Okay, that's good to know. What do we do about that? That's part two, you know. So,
Dean, I'm going to regret saying this, but after spending all this time reading about the brain and interviewing people like yourself and interviewing people like Raul Jandia, the brain surgeon, people like that, it's every time I watch a football match and watching people head footballs and I'm thinking,
oh, yeah,
my childhood and like the amount of times I was heading balls, I now look at it and think, oh my God, that is so crazy that we've got this little bit of thing wobbling around in a bit of jelly. And when you watch rugby and NFL and boxing and MMA and all that sort of stuff, you think, Christ, that is, because our brain's quite delicate, isn't it? It's not even made of muscle. It's made of the gungy stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. Obviously, brain tissue, gray matter, white matter, it's all nerve cells, and the connections are, like I say, quite delicate and quite fragile and quite easily disrupted. I think, yeah, I feel the same thing. It's like any activity which involves getting your head slammed repeatedly is not really easy to watch when you're a neuroscientist or when you have any sort of awareness of the brain. And it is more robust than that, I suppose. Like, I mean, people like drink all the time and that sort of throws the workers of your brain out of whack, but it does get better. The brain's also quite a weirdly resilient organ. But when it's like persistent over time, then yeah, it only has a finite capacity to fix itself. And, you know, I think we do a lot more stuff that challenges that limit than we perhaps should. So yeah, I'm very much in agreement with your view on this.
Yeah, it's just a weird thing to see, but I don't want to be the guy who says, you just think maybe football, we should stop heading the ball now. But I don't want to be that guy. But but it just seems such a bizarre thing now. I watch it and I'm, especially when they go up and they get a head clash or something, I'm going, oh my God, really? That's like,
yeah,
kind of, that's really dangerous. And
then
and I really struggle with watching boxing these days because you're watching someone's head go back constantly. You're thinking, it cannot be good for their brains. I'm watching so anyway. Look, I don't want to ruin sport for people because people totally. Dean, thank you so much for joining me today. Your book Psychological is out now, and it's Why Mental Health Goes Wrong and How to Make Sense of It. We haven't even touched the sides, really, have we? There's so much in this book, and I love the fact that at the end you could have written the book 10 times over because there's so much to learn about it. But it's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining me, Dean.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Anytime.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Maytag laundry appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your home's unique needs and style. Shop Maytag 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location. Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Whirlpool kitchen appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your kitchen's unique needs and style. Shop Whirlpool 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.